Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. My guest today is Cantor Ellen Tillum. Since 1994, she has been a member of the clergy at Temple Emeth, a Reform congregation in Teaneck, New Jersey. In Jewish tradition, the cantor is a musician trained in the vocal arts who leads the congregation in prayer along with a rabbi. But there's so much more. Cantor Tillum officiates at weddings, funerals, and baby namings. She works with bar and bat mitzvah students, teaches in the religious school, as well as adult education programs. An experienced pastoral counselor, Cantor Tillum leads healing services throughout the year, and she also conducts the temple's trio of choirs. Passionate about inter-Jewish relations, she works to foster a deeper appreciation and understanding of the major movements within Judaism. A member of the American Conference of Cantors, Ellen Tillum received her bachelor's degree in voice with a minor in Jewish studies from the University of Hartford Hart School of Music and Greenberg Center for Judaic Studies. She completed hospital chaplaincy training at New York University Medical Center in Manhattan and Methodist Hospital in Brooklyn. She recently also had the honor of offering the invocation and benediction at the New Jersey State Legislature, first session of the new term of senators. So let's meet and get to know my guest today. Cantor Ellen, welcome and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sandy. It's great to be here.
So is this something that you aspired to do as a child, combining music and religion?
As a child, a very young child, 6 or 7 years old, I wanted to be a cantor. That's what I wanted. And at the time, there were no women cantors, not in any form of Judaism. But for me, I just enjoyed being in synagogue. I enjoyed connecting with God through prayer. I mostly enjoyed the singing and the music. And that was what I said. Like a child would say, I want to be a firefighter or,
right.
Mm-hmm. Or you know,
a policeman.
I wanted to be a cantor.
I mean, you had to have been an anomaly at 6 years old thinking that.
It was unusual, especially for a girl at that time, but it seemed natural to me.
This obviously never left you. And the older you got, the more determined, I'm assuming, you were to pursue this career.
Exactly. And then by that time, there started to be, in the Reform movement, women cantors. Now, growing up, I wasn't Reform at all. I had never been inside a Reform synagogue. I grew up conservative Jewish, mm-hmm. really typically conservative Jewish.
For people who might not know mm-hmm. what that means.
Okay, so there are three major movements. There are many movements of Judaism, and they're all lovely, but there are three major movements of Judaism: Orthodox, conservative, and Reform. Orthodox being the most observant of commandments, of exactly what's written in Torah, in Old Testament, and carrying out those commandments on a daily basis. Conservative is kind of more middle of the road, and excuse me to my conservative friends, I'm not really versed in explaining conservative Judaism except for the fact that there are conservative Jews who will keep kosher and conservative Jews who will not keep kosher. There are conservative Jews who will drive on Shabbat and conservative Jews who will not drive on Shabbat. And they're all conservative Jews. So there's a much more broader spectrum of Jewish observance and level of Jewish observance. Reform Judaism, the most liberal of the three movements, one is not expected to adhere to certain commandments or mitzvot, a level of observance, but still holds to understanding and following of Torah, of the Old Testament, and certainly adheres to an understanding and following of the idea of one God, just as the other two movements do. And so while you could have a Reform Jew that follows certain commandments, such as keeping strictly kosher or keeping strictly Shabbat, it's much rarer.
There's more flexibility
there
in Reform Judaism.
There is much more flexibility mm-hmm. in Reform Judaism of interpretation. So, mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. within that, the prayers themselves are interpreted differently in the three major movements.
So what was it for you growing up? Was it the spirituality and the beauty of the music that you thought you could combine the two, as opposed to saying to yourself, I'm spiritual, I'm religious, and I'd like to be on Broadway?
Right. I get asked that all the time. You mean you didn't just think, oh, I'd like to be a Broadway singer or a pop singer mm-hmm. or something else and be Jewish at home?
Clearly, there's nothing wrong with being right. a cantor. I'm not going
there's
in that direction.
There's nothing wrong with any of it. You know, there's lots of, thank God, there's lots of beautiful voices out there. But for me, there was something about watching the cantor, in Hebrew, the chazan, on the bima, on the, for lack of a better term, on the altar, and saying that really speaks to me. I could do that, that sort of singing. And in addition, Jewish music was always my focus. I never sang Broadway. I sang enough opera to get through school because you must, but never really enjoyed it. But when I sing Jewish music, it feels different to me. And by Jewish music, I mean cantorial music, Israeli music, Yiddish music,
liturgical,
all of these things. 100% liturgical music. Those things really always spoke to me. And even as a young child, that's the type of music that I enjoyed singing. And my family was very involved in that sort of music. It was always around me. So my father and my uncle were always playing in bands or playing instruments in our home. And most of that was Jewish music.
So when you were growing up, did you star in the school play? In a school musical?
Once or twice I would be in a musical, but I never really...
That wasn't your thing.
No, I never enjoyed it. I never got very far with that.
So it's interesting that you were on a very focused path, in spite of the fact that you didn't see anybody female at the altar.
Right. It was very, very focused all the time. I never left that path. I always... There wasn't a time in my life when I said, oh, maybe I'll do something else or some other kind of... Never. I always wanted to do this. And as far as not seeing women doing this, it just didn't matter. It was a non-issue. It didn't occur to me that women could or could not do this. It just wasn't something I thought about.
So you assumed you'd get a job.
By the time I was ready to go to cantorial school, which is a post-college program, now a five-year program after college.
This was after the University of Hartford?
Yes, right. So I went...
So you're in school for 4 years.
I am already in school for 4 years
right.
With voice and Jewish studies. And then what I really wanted to do was go to the conservative seminary, right? You have a choice of Reform, Conservative, Orthodox. Orthodox seminary period was not open to women at that time, is still not open to women in that venue. The conservative seminary, while I was...
In New York, by the way?
All in New York, yes. What you must do in each of the conservative and reform seminaries for sure is you must spend a year in Israel and then come back and do the rest of your studies in New York. There's not another option, really, right? So at that time that I was in undergraduate school, the conservative movement began to accept women into school, into
cantorial
seminary, into cantorial school. However, you could not then join their professional organization. Women were not yet invited into their professional organization and therefore could not get a job necessarily. There were congregations that would interview women, but they didn't have to. They could say, we're not interviewing women. You could go and sit through your 5 years at the Jewish Theological Seminary, the Conservative Seminary, and by and large not be called on by teachers that simply didn't want to call on you. There was no reason for them to do it if they didn't want to and they hadn't voted for women to come in. It wasn't available to you. So I decided that even though I was really a conservative Jew, I would go to the Reform Seminary. Again, it became for me, and it still is, a non-issue. So whether you're male or female, if you're doing a great job as a cantor, go do it, period. There was no reason for me to...
But did you ever think at some point, not that this would be an exercise in futility, that's not what I mean, but that you might have difficulty marrying your passion with a profession?
No. No. It never occurred to me because, again, I was very, very focused. And I, coming into then the Reform Seminary, at that time, there are many more women now. At that time, it was... 40% women, 30% women, let's say. I don't know exactly. But I never thought that for a minute that I wouldn't have a pulpit when I came out.
You never felt that that was going to be an obstacle for
you? No, I never felt that. And, well, within the Reform movement at that time, it was common for pulpits to hire women. There was no prejudice about it. You could apply anywhere and get hired anywhere. What was interesting, and I always remember this because I think nowadays you can't ask this, but they said to me in my interview, even at Temple Emeth at the time, how do you see yourself as a woman in the cantorate, right? They wanted to see if my being a woman influenced my cantorate influenced my pulpit at all.
Uh-huh.
So
uh-huh.
To which I said, I don't. I happen to be a woman. And if I'm the best cantor for this pulpit, then I am. And that was it. That was the end of that discussion. The congregation learned very quickly that that was just not something that I was going to bring up or play.
No. So in other words, it's not that
it's
you could
non-issue.
Bring another layer right. as a female, right. as a woman, right. with you know, with all the stereotypes that are attached to that, the extra empathy, the understanding.
Right. If I'm empathetic, then I am.
Right.
So I know right. a lot of empathetic men as well.
I understand.
So
mm-hmm.
so it just didn't occur to me to, and I think that stemmed from, as a child, that my parents really encouraged me to be a cantor. Once they saw that this was something that I wanted and that would be for me, there was no question. It was a non-issue. And when the reform movement began to invest women cantors, my father literally went out and found these women. They were few and far between at the time, and took me to go hear them. And he would bring me to have an example of women in the cantorate. But we never used the word anything about feminist or girl or boy. It was a non-issue. It was simply, you want to be a cantor, and we think you should. And they pushed me toward that, and they gave me all these, you know, billions of dollars of singing lessons and whatever else I needed, and they would.
Well, they
you know,
how wonderful that they were your allies, as 100%. Opposed to saying, "Gee, right. I don't know if this," you right. know.
No, and even my grandparents in their generation, you know, they were completely supportive.
But do you know what's interesting about this role, this profession, is it's not simply that one has to have a talent as a singer. Yeah, there has to be an empathy. There has to be an understanding. There has to be a spirituality in religion. You're just not up there singing, you know,
right, you can't,
a hymn, for heaven's sake.
Right, you can't get up on the bima, on the pulpit, and just sing. You have to be able to feel that. You have to want to bring people to God and bring people to prayer. And singing is a very small part of my job.
But it's a powerful part.
It is, and I think it guides people. But if you're, you know, if you can sing beautifully and then you're a lousy pastoral counselor, I think that then
well,
this isn't the place for you.
right.
So you have to really want to feel what people are feeling, and you have to want to have patience when they're not able to connect with God, with religion, with others. And when people are in pain most of the time, it's very, very hard to connect. And you have to be able to feel that, to look inside and say, what can I do to bring someone closer? And you have to really care. People will smell it if you don't care. They know.
That you're just phoning it
oh,
in.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. They know. Mm-hmm. So you must really be able to crack yourself wide open
uh-huh.
and take on someone else's pain and really want to do that. People know if you're not doing it, and you won't have as good a result, by the way. You won't be able to reach people by just, you know, kind of, oh, I know how you feel. That's not practical.
That's also like phoning it in a sense.
Yeah, not realistic.
Talk about what it means to be a pastoral counselor.
For me, pastoral counseling is what I enjoy. If a cantor friend of mine heard this, they would just be so upset. I enjoy that much more than I enjoy singing. I happen to be able to sing, but I would much rather do pastoral counseling all day long. And that is because with pastoral counseling, you're not a therapist, so you have to draw those lines, and you have to know, the pastoral counselor must know that they are not a therapist. Many pastoral counselors are trained as therapists. But what makes me able to counsel people is empathy and experience. So once you've been doing this for as many years as I have, 24 years now of people with hundreds of different issues in and out of my office, mostly people who are grieving, who are in need of bereavement counseling. That's most of what I do. You learn how to open up to people and how to not just empathize, but really feel what they're feeling, even if it's for the moment. You must be able to care about another person so deeply that it's almost like you care for your own child. If your own child's in pain and you have that deep, deep empathy that you want to take it from them, you want to be the one in pain. It's important to be able to feel that way about someone else, maybe someone you've never even met. Sometimes people come in for bereavement counseling or pastoral counseling that are strangers. I don't know them. But if I can open up enough and feel their grief or their pain, I have a better chance of helping them. And it's important to me to do that.
Do you always connect?
Almost all the time. I don't like to say it that way because I don't like to suppose, but most of the time I'll get a call from somebody after or a letter after, or you can feel that. If you're not connecting, you can feel it. And it's rare that I'm not connecting.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do it. I want to be part of someone else's pain for that time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want that and you're able to do it, you know,
I guess
will connect.
That can't be taught. Somebody can have a really great singing voice and can pick up, you know, the nuances and the spirituality of a song, but sitting opposite each other.
Look, God gives everyone gifts,
mm-hmm.
particular sets of gifts and skill sets. And so for me, I have those, let's call them two things that I can do easily.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes sense for me to be in a pulpit clergy. It makes sense. And it's always made sense.
Are there days when sometimes it just seems so hard?
No, I enjoy it all the time. Like anybody, maybe I'm down with the flu or something.
Well,
that
sure.
makes it harder, but,
right.
But
right,
no,
right.
I always want to go in and counsel. I always want to meet with a family who's grieving. I always want to be with them in their time of need. And look, there are other life cycle events that I do. I certainly officiated baby namings or weddings, and those are lovely too. But for me personally, I mostly connect with people when they're grieving. That's
mm-hmm.
just natural.
I was going to use that word. It's a natural
act
for
me. So no, there aren't days when it's hard. There are times, families that are harder to connect with than others maybe, or if they've had, God forbid, a tragedy. Or these are hard things, but it doesn't make it hard for me to go in there.
Mm-hmm.
They make it harder to deal with them. I have to think more. I have to figure out how can I reach them? How can I get in there? How can I make them feel that somebody cares? There's that, but there's not – when you say are there days that are hard, it's like almost like, are there days you don't want to go in and do this? And the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
I always want to go in and do this. You also have to be able to go home to your kids and, you know, hi, how was school?
Right,
you know,
right.
You mustn't
switch gears.
Not, you know, dump this on your family and carry it around for 6 days. You have to know how to do that. After I've seen a family, I'll allow myself, you know, time, maybe a cry
mm-hmm.
if I really need to. Never with a family
mm-hmm.
because they don't need me crying. They're crying. They need me to stand strong and,
for
and
sure.
be there.
Uh-huh.
Not every pastoral counselor agrees with that. Many pastoral counselors say it's okay to cry with a family. I try not to. But that having been said, now I'm going to contradict myself a bit, which is that when you've been in a pulpit for many years, like I've been at Temple Emeth, you know, for 24 years, people in the congregation that you've known for all those years pass away, that's a little rough because – you know them. You've
for
known
sure.
them all these
yes,
years.
Of course.
You know,
it's business. For
I got
sake.
There when I was 26, so
mm-hmm.
I grew up with them. You know,
yeah.
they were there when my children were born. They were there when I've had challenging times in my life, whatever that is. So that is a little more challenging in a way because I'm trying to be professional, but at the same time, sure. I'm crying too, you know.
Because there's a history.
There's a history. You're connected with that person like a family member.
Exactly.
And a synagogue is a family. So you really do feel like these are your family members.
So in other words, I could have a really great singing voice, for example, and I could really—
You could.
I don't.
Right.
But my point being, maybe not everybody should be a cantor.
There's plenty of Jews with good voices. Doesn't make you cut out for the cantorate. And you especially a pulpit cantor, you know, you're a pulpit clergy. You're dealing with all of that also.
Define that.
Anyone who's been in a pulpit, whether any religion doesn't matter, but any minister of any pulpit mm-hmm. deals day in and day out with lots and lots and lots of personalities and everything that comes with that. And, you know, you have to try to be kind to everybody all the time. That's the job. You know, sometimes people are not at their best and you can get that and mm-hmm. you have to work through that because these are your congregants and you're there to take care of them. It's a lot of caregiving in that way.
Right, right.
Plus the fact that you're in the workings of a synagogue. So a synagogue also has, you know, meetings and classes and a board mm-hmm. and a, you know, so you must be able to mm-hmm. to deal with all of that. And that's what it is. That's the job.
Were there any surprises for you when you began your career?
No. I mean, look, you're coming out of a very long graduate program. So you are prepared pretty well. And then within your graduate program, by the way, you have what's called a student pulpit. All rabbis and cantors, at least in Reform and conservative movements, I don't know how Orthodox clergy work, but in Reform and conservative, you have a student pulpit. So you're in a pulpit before you actually graduate. So you can see most of that. I don't think that there was really anything shocking. I mean, every day is different because you're dealing with different people and mm-hmm. different, you're teaching and, you know, but no, not surprising.
Describe a healing service.
So a healing service is a Reform Jewish innovation only. Well, the first thing we want to do is not think of a healing service in a sense of, you know, where you put your hands on someone and they're healed. And, well, I think, look, I don't even like to laugh at that. I mean, look, there are plenty of religions that believe that and do that all the time. And if it works for them, that's great.
Well, sometimes we can be very patronizing.
Well, yeah, mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of religion in general, mm-hmm. so okay. Mm-hmm. But for us as Reformed Jews, and I can speak to my healing service at Temple Emeth, it's a spiritual healing service so that we are reading poems and prayers and we're singing music that is comforting and soothing and reminds us mostly of God's nearness at all times, whether those times are of, you know, joy or sorrow, whether in death or in celebration, all of these times God is there waiting for us if we wish to see him, if mm-hmm. we wish to connect with God's presence. So that's what a healing service is almost like a reminder of that, because people are going through difficult times for different reasons. So you can get a healing service with, you know, 40 people, and every one of them is there for a different reason. Someone lost a loved one. Someone is there because they heard something on the news that upset them. Someone is there because, you know, they lost their job. Someone is there because they're feeling depressed for one reason or another. Someone is there because they're feeling the joy and celebration of having a grandchild, and they are trying to have an even deeper connection. Mm. So that's what it's about. It's not at all about making anybody better. Mm-hmm. It's about making people feel that there's hope.
Is there ever a time that you don't have any hope?
Me personally?
Yes, you personally.
No. Because I know that God is there. It's sometimes I run out of patience with God. You know, I'm waiting. Where is it? Where's mm-hmm. this thing I asked for or that I need or that I want? And the way that I get around that is I look back on the times where I've experienced miracles in my lifetime and I've experienced God's presence. And then I remember that, and that helps me to get through whatever that the next time is.
Can you share an experience of a miracle?
Well, I love sharing this story. That's why you hear a smile in my voice. So for our family, we experienced a miracle, and this was very, very special for us. So at the time that I got married in 2001, I had a child from my first marriage, and I told my my husband now, when I married him, that I had some difficulty getting pregnant and we would need some medical intervention. I knew that already from the first time that I had a child. And so as we began our process of having medical intervention, IUI, IVF, all of these things that we do, I found that I was not getting pregnant and that I, you know, may not be able to get pregnant. And my husband, I had a child already. He did not have children. He wanted children. I was happy to have another child. And so we decided to begin a process of adoption. And we began our process by filling out paperwork with an agency to go to China to adopt a child. As soon as we, you know, got about halfway through the process, it's for people that don't know, it's a long process adopting a baby, especially from a foreign country. We were about halfway through all of that paperwork. And at that point, I had tried in vitro again, and I became pregnant with twins. And so we decided that we weren't going to have three children at once. Mm-hmm. So I stopped the adoption process. We hadn't seen a child yet. We simply were in this process. And I went on with my pregnancy. And in the fourth month of the pregnancy, I lost one of the twins. I went on to have the other child, who's now my beautiful middle girl. And we decided that was it. We have another child. We're happy. But in the back of our minds was always the fact that there are all these little girls that are left in orphanages in China, and we weren't going to be able to get that out of our heads.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided that we'd go back and continue the adoption
process.
Pick
up where you kind of left off.
We could pick up where we left off because we hadn't gone that far in the amount of time between the time we stopped the process and the time we continued it. So at that point, there was a medical exam required for adoption from China. And so my husband and I both had our medical exams. And he has a doctor who is kind of old-fashioned and just did a complete exam and did a chest x-ray in office as part of this exam. Even though the chest x-ray was not required, he did it anyway. And a few days later, we got a call, and my husband's doctor said to him, "Look, there's something in your chest x-ray. We don't know what it is. You could have a clogged artery. We're not really sure. You should go get it checked out." We thought to ourselves, "Ugh, you know, what a pain." And eventually my husband went and had an MRI, and they found that he had a large tumor on his thymus gland. It was sitting between his heart and his lung. It was quite large, and it was called a thymic carcinoma, thymoma. Most often, thymoma presents without signs of, you know,
any symptoms?
Myasthenia gravis, mm-hmm. other things that you can get. He had no symptoms at all,
mm-hmm.
completely asymptomatic. So while we were continuing with our adoption process, my husband ended up going to have surgery, chemo. He had chemo first to shrink the tumor and then surgery. He was in the hospital for a long time and at home sick for a long time. And shortly thereafter, we got a call that there was a baby for us in China. And we ended up going and adopting our baby, who is now our baby, who's going to be, God willing, 13 in a few days. And we never would have found that tumor. And many doctors have told us that that sort of tumor, if you don't find it, if there are no outward symptoms, you simply stop breathing.
Wow.
So it was really a miracle that, you know, you can look back and say, why didn't I get pregnant? Why did I lose one of those twins? All of these things that you question God about day in and day out. Why me? How come this happened? But we don't see the greater plan mm-hmm. until we can look back on it.
Wow.
This never would have happened had we not gone back to the adoption, or had we not started adopting in the first place. And all of the timing of being able to see this tumor on a chest x-ray, it had to be big enough to see. There was so many little pieces to this, but it was really an incredible statement of God's presence in our lives. I was connected to God before that, But this really solidified that.
Yeah, I can certainly see how.
So, and I try and share that story as often as possible because I think that people don't realize that there are miracles happening in their lives. They don't realize that there is a plan, and sometimes these things are happening and we don't realize that they're miracles, that they're, you know, this is actually from God. It's not just some
random coincidence.
Mm-hmm. Right?
As you look back over your career and you travel back in time to when you were 6 years old, you are where you want to be because you knew you had to go there.
It elicits gratitude, gratefulness to God for bringing me on the path that I'm meant to be on and realizing what that path is and staying on it.
But your determination and your commitment and your passion is as much a part of the equation as God is, and your talent.
And all that are gifts that were given to me. And everybody has those. Like I said, everybody has those gifts that mm-hmm. are given to them mm-hmm. to bring them on their path, you know. I'm not surprised because it just seemed obvious to me. But yes, you have to – you do have to have some stick with it-ness mm-hmm. to do anything, mm-hmm. to do anything, whatever that is. I'm not surprised by it, but I'm grateful for it, and I'm in the place where I want to be right now. And that feels good to say because, you know what? I'm going to turn 50 this year. I say it right into the microphone. I feel very proud,
uh-huh.
very excited.
You look great.
I'm not one of those women that's worried about saying my age. Mm-hmm. It's very cool. So for me, I think I'm at a good place.
We've run out of time, but before we say so long, do you sing around the house a lot? Are you always singing?
That's funny. No. No. It's
you in the car,
like
you got the radio
yes.
on.
Yes. Oh, yeah, sure. I sing with the radio. Sure. Doesn't everybody?
Well, I mean, but, you know, it's a pleasure to probably be in the car with you when you're singing along into the radio.
I'm not really a great – I listen to a lot of classic rock. I don't think I'm so good at it, but darn, it's fun to sing.
I really want to thank you for sharing a conversation with me. I learned a lot. I wish you continued happiness and joy in your life.
Thank you so much.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Everybody.